bill brings Oregon into compliance with federal requirements, and the agency is here to explain both the bill, the federal requirements, Oregon's current practices regarding unemployment assurance and transfers, and they will also may be able to discuss the fiscal impact. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Renee Bryan, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of committee. My name is Renee Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T. I am the manager of the Unemployment Insurance Tax Section of the Employment Department. And I'm here this morning to talk to you about unemployment insurance tax law. I'm happy to see everyone here so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed excited to talk about tax law. And I'll try to keep this as exciting as possible for you so that you don't fall asleep. The purpose of this bill is to bring our current tax laws into conformity with some recently passed federal legislation. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is what is conformity and why do we care about it. The unemployment insurance program is a federal program administered by each of the 50 states individually. Because we are a federal program, we are required to comply with certain aspects that the federal government tells us to comply with. In certain ways, we're allowed to do anything we want to. In exchange, what we have is an agreement that the federal government will send us money to administer our program, and Oregon employers receive a credit against their federal unemployment taxes that they have to pay to the federal government. We have two kinds of taxes that employers pay on payroll. One is a state tax and one is a federal tax. State taxes go up to 5.4%. Federal taxes are 6.2%. But as long as we are in compliance with the federal requirements, our Oregon employers get a 5.4% credit against their federal taxes, so they end up paying basically an 0.4% difference. So it's important to stay in conformity. If we go out of conformity, our program will be decertified. What that will mean to us financially is that we would lose about $100 million over the biennium for the administration of the program, and Oregon employers would pay upwards of $950 million in additional taxes. So we want to, when we come in and we start talking about conformity, we consider this a very serious issue for Oregon businesses. Now, the background of this bill is that the summer of 2004, Congress passed a bill, and the President signed it, requiring all states to enact certain laws that will prohibit tax rate manipulation. This is sometimes also called pseudo-dumping. You may hear that term used here and there. The unemployment system is like any other insurance system, and it's based upon an application of an experience rating. Just like with automobiles, if you have a high risk as a driver, you're going to have a higher insurance rate that you have to pay. The same in the states. If you have a bad experience rating as an employer, you're going to end up paying a higher amount of taxes. If employers can find ways to manipulate their experience and either hide it or disguise it somehow, effectively dumping that experience, a couple of things occur. Number one, they get an unfair advantage over the other businesses who perform like they do. Other employers end up paying more in taxes because all of these taxes go into one fund. It's a socialized cost, if you will. And so just like with car insurance, if someone has a wreck and they're uninsured, you and I are going to pay for that. Same thing with unemployment insurance. If someone's not paying their fair share based on their correct experience rating, other businesses are going to pay for that. Smaller employers generally suffer the most with these kinds of situations because they don't have the incentive to manipulate their tax rates, their tax experience. And there's a higher impact then on the smaller employers because they end up paying higher rates of taxes and higher amounts of taxes. And overall, as I said, depending on how much manipulation goes on, it could result in higher taxes for all Oregon businesses. Our taxes are determined based upon the solvency of the trust fund in some part, and if our trust fund goes down below a certain level, tax rates will go up. So we want to keep as much money in the trust fund as possible by equitably administering our taxes, and tax rate manipulation helps to, or sometimes causes problems with this. Now, Oregon is already ahead of the pack in terms of what the federal government requires for conformity. We've always required that when 100% of a business is transferred, that the experience of the business is going to follow. And in 1999, we enacted legislation which required that when a portion of a business is transferred, the portion of the experience attributable to that employer is also going to be transferred. So there are a lot of states that don't do that, and they're in the process right now of changing their laws. But we already have that in place. There are a couple of things that I've outlined in the testimony, though, that we don't have in Oregon, which we are going to have to change in order to conform with the federal legislation. The number one thing is that under current law, an employing unit that had not previously existed can acquire an existing employer and in that way acquire their existing experience. I'm an employer who never existed before. I go out, I buy a corporate shell that has low experiences, maybe even closed down for some period of time. And suddenly, instead of getting the new employer rate, which is going to be for this year 3.2%, I'll get a 1.8% rate. So I'm going to start off not paying my fair share. Federal government will not allow us to do this anymore. They say that if we determine, and only if we determine, that the purpose of the acquisition of the existing employing unit is for the purposes of avoiding your experience rating, that we cannot allow that to occur. You can buy whatever you want, but we're still going to give you the new employer rate. The other parts of the federal legislation that we need to comply with have to do with the penalties. Right now, the most serious penalty that we can apply in Oregon is a fraud penalty. If we go out right now and under our existing laws determine that someone's trying to avoid their experience rating for the purpose of avoiding their taxes, we can apply up to a 50% fraud penalty. That's a pretty heavy penalty to apply. But we don't do it that very often. Fraud is very, very difficult to prove. You have to prove an intent. And so it's not something that we go to very often. Right now, our only criminal sanctions are misdemeanor sanctions. They come up with fines of up to $500 and 90 days in jail. I've been associated with the Employment Department now for about 20 years. I've never been aware of us ever using that section of the law. I can imagine a lot of district attorneys just laughing and laughing if we went in to say, hey, we'd like for you to bring charges for this tax avoidance scheme. The federal government wants us to enact penalties that will be significant enough not merely to punish a violator but also to deter other violators or future violations. So the federal government has proposed, and we have adopted, a method of doing this. And on the civil side, it would be if we find a violator, someone who is trying to manipulate their taxes, we would be imposing an additional tax rate up to the maximum amount. And if the maximum amount doesn't equal at least 2 percentage points higher than what they were paying before, then 2% above the maximum rate. So a really serious rate that would apply for the next 3 years to violators that we find here. And in addition, we are proposing some significant criminal penalties. We are proposing a Class C felony violation, which is consistent with other types of financial fraud violations that you find throughout Oregon chapters. One of the most interesting things about the federal legislation is what they are requiring us to do with respect to the individuals who advise employers to engage in these types of schemes. One of the big proponents of the pseudo-dumping legislation in Congress was Carl Camden, the COO of Kelly Services in Michigan. And he testified that he was contacted by all 10 of the big accounting firms urging his company to engage in tax rate manipulation. And they calculated that Kelly Services could save up to about $20 million if they did so. Mr. Camden was outraged by this, and he was the spearhead in Congress for this new legislation for exactly the reasons we talked about earlier, because he didn't want his competitors to have an advantage that he wasn't ethically going to take. So what this bill requires us to do is that for businesses or individuals who knowingly advise a business employer to engage in what would be prohibited tax rate manipulation, that we would bring civil penalties against those advisors up to $10,000. Now, because the depth and breadth of these proposed civil and criminal violations is such a big difference from what we had previously, we're also proposing a period of amnesty. What we would like is to have a chance to educate employers, to make sure they have a chance to come forward voluntarily and tell us, gee, you know, maybe we didn't do this right, could you help us untangle this? In that event, the Employment Department will be willing to waive any penalties or interest, which could be significant in some of these cases, and to forego prosecution in any of these cases for a period of a year for any employer who voluntarily comes forward. This bill will bring us into conformity. One of the things I wanted to let the panel know about this morning was that we have talked with some of the businesses who have been who may be affected by this bill, notably the PEO organizations, professional employer organizations, leasing companies, if you will. They were concerned that this bill might require the Employment Department to transfer experience when a leasing company acquires a new client and those employees become the employee of the leasing company. We have not in the past treated those transactions as covered by the tax law in Oregon. We have no intention of doing so as a result of the application of this bill. We've had conversations with representatives of the industry, and I wanted to make sure that we had this on the record. We had a good conversation and talked about the necessity to have further conversations to figure out how, given the changes in the business world, how tracking experience should occur. But that's not the purpose of this legislation this morning. We did offer some amendments, and Mr. Chair, if you wish me to discuss those, I'll do
would
that now.
Please, okay. Yeah.
Our amendments are basically clarifying amendments. We are talking here in this bill about a couple of different rates, tax rates and experience rates. So there are a couple places in the amendments we want to clarify that we're talking about tax rates and how we're going to apply tax rates as opposed to experience ratings. We also want to make sure, and this was something we discovered after the bill had been printed, we would have a pretty significant programming issue with our IT department if we were required to immediately impose a new tax rate upon an employer in the middle of the tax rate year. So what we propose to do is take out the language that would require us to do that in the quarter preceding, the quarter following, and wait until the new tax rate year to impose any new tax rate upon a violator. And then finally, the amendment adds an effective date. We would like to ask that this legislation be made effective at the beginning of the next tax rate year, which would be 2006. And, Mr. Chair, I am available to answer any questions. I'm sure this is all perfectly clear.
What happens if we don't do this? What does the federal government do to us?
The federal government, if we do not conform with these requirements, will commence a decertification process. They will bring an action to decertify the unemployment insurance program, and as I said, the consequences would be that they would no longer send us our administrative funding, about $100 million per biennium, and Oregon employers would have to pay the full FUTA rate, which is 6.2%. They would get no credit against any unemployment insurance they paid in the state of Oregon.
So if my accountant told me that he thinks it would be a good idea if I went out and established a new business to some way lower my unemployment tax, he's in big trouble right along with me if this bill passes.
That's a potential, Chairman Brown, except that I expect that you would say, you know, you ought to call the unemployment insurance tax section, talk with them, and I bet they'll help us do this the right way.
Representative Schaffler.
Thanks. I support this. It's a good idea. You know, there's a lot of folks out there that want to weasel out of paying their taxes, and I'm not for that. But my question is, I'd imagine there's a possibility that some honest person, otherwise completely honest person, could unwittingly find themselves in this position if they had an accountant, like the chair alluded to. That, and what if they just say, look, you can do this, save money, and aren't given all the information? How do we handle that? And the second thing is, since it's so difficult to prove fraud, there seems to be some subjectivity here. Do you have the resources to really go after these folks the ones that you really feel in your heart are guilty. So there's two things there.
Representative Brown and Representative Schaffler, first to the issue of resources, we have 48 auditors in the field who are charged with assisting in the voluntary compliance of our tax laws of over 105,000 Oregon employers. So I think it's fair to say our resources are limited. We typically find situations involving tax rate manipulation based upon a tip. However, some competitor calls and says, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm playing by the rules and so-and-so isn't. You ought to go over there and audit. And we will follow up on that perhaps and do an audit. These are not the typical kinds of audits that we do. They take a lot of time, a lot of resources to dot every I and cross every T. And the burden with respect to this new bill is that we need to be able to show that the activity was taken on solely or primarily for the purposes of avoiding the tax rate. So we do believe we have the resources to identify the quote-unquote bad guys. It's our intention to work very hard with the good guys to put them back on the right track. As we said, with the kind of resources that we have, the best way that we can ensure that we have an equitable system for all employers is to do everything we can to encourage voluntary compliance, to put out as much information as we can to educate employers, to show them the right way to do things, to be available as a resource, to help them file their reports correctly, to work with the professional communities, the lawyers and the CPAs, to help them understand the law so that they can assist us in doing it the right way. And Representative Schaffler, did I answer all of your questions?
Well, it's a hard job. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other question? Representative Holder.
You had mentioned the professional employment agencies or, temp agencies or labor agents, labor brokers. How do you treat unemployment rates or the employment experience rate for those organizations?
Representative Brown and Representative Holvey, currently if a leasing organization reports to us that they have 400 employees that report to them as employees and they lease out to other clients, we evaluate their experience based upon their reports to us of who their employees are. In those situations where, for instance, I can tell you that there have been a couple of companies we've identified who have set up some shell corporations, waited for those corporations to obtain a low experience rating, and then they just move employees over. They don't even go through the process necessarily of acquiring anything. They just transfer their payroll. And there have been a couple of situations where we've had to track the movement of employees that have gone back and forth between these organizations to try to figure out what the proper experience rating for the business enterprise should be. But generally speaking, we rely on employers to tell us the truth. And we do not treat the transfer of a client employee base to the leasing company as a transfer of experience. Again, this is something that we discuss with the representatives of PEO industry. We have no intent of doing that in the future as a result of this bill, but it's probably something we need to look at in the future and make some determinations in connection with conversations with business to find out if maybe we should.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of these professional employment agencies then could, you know, have a group of, say, office workers at one rate and a group of construction workers that are, you know, have a different experience rate, and those two rates are then combined for their total employee rate of that. Is that how it works?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, if I'm understanding your question correctly, yes. If you have one business that has different types of employees, some are laborers, some are professionals, yes. If you're one leasing company or you have a variety of small entities but you're basically acting as one leasing company, you've got all the same management, one couldn't basically exist without the other, we're going to give those entities one rate.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Rini, is there a physical impact from this? Is there? Did you? I can't recall whether you talked about that or not.
Representative Brown, we sent over a fiscal impact statement which shows effective on expenditures to be zero. It's our intention that we absorb any costs of enforcement with the existing workforce that we have right now. We're not, if we adopt the amendments that we propose, we're not anticipating any significant programming costs to change the way that we would recalculate tax rates. It's a crapshoot how much we're going to get in terms of additional revenue. In the past 2 years, we have identified about $12 million in manipulated taxes.
Wow.
Whether or not that holds true for the future, we don't know. We don't know if we've gotten most of the bad guys already and everybody's doing things fine. But we have proposed here that we might have upwards of $1,400,000 per biennium for increased revenue, or about $700,000 a year, I believe, is what we've got here. Yeah. But it could be lots more. It could be much less. The other factor that comes into play with this is whether or not the amounts that we identify as unpaid taxes is actually collectible.
Okay. So the $12 million you talked about, that's under the amnesty. You won't be able to go back and get that, huh?
Well, again, as I explained earlier, our laws are pretty sufficient to get at some of these things now, and we are trying very hard to do that and to educate businesses not to engage in these types of activities. But no, we feel that we have assessed these taxes that we've already identified properly, and if we can collect them, we want to do that.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Tom Barrows.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning and happy Monday to you all. I'm Tom Barrows, representing the National Association of Professional Employer Organizations, NAPO. We have had extensive discussions, as Ms. Bryant said, with the Employment Department about the legislation and the amendments. We are okay with them, including the amendments, and I just want to thank the department for reaching out and having conversations with us ahead of time, meeting with us, and being willing to listen. I've experienced other state agencies that have not always done that, and it usually creates problems, and so I just want to give them credit for having the foresight to do that. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I don't see any, Tom. Thank you
very much.
Thanks, Tom.
So, Janet, this goes back to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need that before it goes to the floor?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2124 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2126. Janet, can you give us a rundown on it?
Yes, members. House Bill 2126 is a second bill at the request of the Employment Department, and it would allow the department to combine or jointly issue an overpayment decision and a decision that disqualifies previously paid benefits. So we're not on the employer side, we're on the employee side now. And the change is in Section 2 of the bill, the bold language. The director or an authorized representative may combine a decision that includes disqualification decision with the decision under those other statutes, 657, 310 to 315, and that's the overpayment, either because of a fraud on the part of the employee or as an error. And, Mr. Chair, the Section 3 of the bill is mostly being rewritten, and that's not there's a lot of language being taken out and rewritten. And Mr. Chair, the purpose of this bill is to save some confusion, because sometimes the decisions are, because they're made consecutively instead of at the same time, a person may not know that they need to appeal one before the other, and then it's too late to appeal the disqualification decision. So this is a part, also a streamlining bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Tom Byerly, please? Morning, Tom.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. Appreciate a chance to describe this bill for you today. As the committee administrator described, there's two aspects to this bill, and the first one I like to call a customer service aspect. While we don't intentionally try to confuse our employee claimant customers, we do have a requirement in current law where if we find somebody ineligible for unemployment insurance benefits that could set up an overpayment, the decision that defines them ineligible has to become final before we can go back and set up the overpayment. And what that means to the claimant, let's say an individual, we find them ineligible for unemployment insurance for a couple weeks. Sometimes a common thing is somebody will, just before they get their next job, they might claim an extra week of benefits because they need the money or they're not sure of their earnings or whatever. We then discover that there's some earnings that impacted those weeks of benefits. We then disqualify them for that week. Well, they're back to work now. They get a letter in the mail that says, oh, I'm disqualified from receiving benefits for that week. Okay. Well, since I'm back to work, I don't really have the time to deal with this right now. But what they've missed is that it sets up a potential overpayment, so they don't really see the monetary impact until later when that decision becomes final. And then we send them a second decision that says, this decision will have found you ineligible on this date, and by the way, it finds you overpaid $600. Suddenly, that gets their attention. Oh my gosh, I got to pay money back. So they then appeal that decision. The problem with that is the decision that found them ineligible has already become final, and it can't be reopened or heard. So then they're stuck paying the bill. And I have to say, I deal with your staff with constituent inquiries that don't quite understand that. And again, we don't intentionally try to fool or trip up our customers. That's just an operation of the current law. And so this law would allow us to combine that disqualification with the overpayment decision, so it would then explain, not only are you ineligible for benefits for this period of time, this is how much you need to repay us. And then it'll make more sense to them in real terms, because you start talking about a financial impact, they'll be more likely to appeal. So then they can have a hearing and get all the issues dealt with once. So it actually prevents some confusion on the claimant's part, but it also can streamline for us, because we have one hearing through the Office of Administrative Hearings and then one appeal if necessary up to the Employment Appeals Board. Secondarily, it will help us on the administrative side. If it does become final and money is owed, we can get a little bit earlier start on collecting that money to help keep our overpayment receivables down, because obviously we're going to save about 30 days probably by combining these decisions after we no longer have to wait for it to become final. So we see this as a real customer service aspect for the customers mainly, so that prevents confusion, but also gives us a jump on getting the collection action started if we really do need to collect the money. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take a shot at.
What kind of time frame does an employee have to appeal one of these kind of decisions?
Chair Byrne, that's a great question. When a decision is issued that finds them ineligible, they have 20 days to appeal that decision. So we, at a minimum, will wait 20 days before setting up the overpayment. If they do take it to a hearing, that hearing decision has a 30-day appeal period. Excuse me, 20 days. And then if they go to the Employment Appeals Board, they have another 30-day appeal period before they could allow them to take it to court. So there's a couple months there that could delay us from setting up the overpayment decision. On the other hand, the overpayment decision itself also has the 20-day appeal period that we would wait before we start collection on that. So we would not start collecting until all those decisions became final.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2126? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2126 and open the work session on House Bill 2126. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Estwell.
He's excused.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Here. I mean, aye.
That's a rare occasion.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Can we probably better have a carrier for it to explain it, huh?
I'll carry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts will be our carrier. Thank you, Representative.
You're welcome.
No.
I can't wait.
We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2463. And Janet, can you give us a
brief resume?
What's going on?
And I hope, Mr. Chair, that all the members appreciate that we were finally able to create a theme day where all three bills have something to do with it, instead of going from landscape contractors to private investigators and who knows what else. So this is the third unemployment insurance-related bill. This is Representative Schaffler's bill, and it exempts unemployment benefits from state personal income taxes. It applies to unemployment benefits that would be paid after January 1, 2006 and for which an exemption is claimed for tax years beginning in 2006. Mr. Chair, the unemployment taxes are taxed at the federal level. Some states have taken the step of eliminating or have never taxed unemployment tax, unemployment insurance tax benefits. Mr. Chair, there is one mistake on the staff measure summary. This has a referral to the Revenue Committee, subsequent to this committee, not to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Schaffler, would you mind if Bob Shiprack joined you up there?
Absolutely.
Bob, please.
Yes, you would mind?
Actually, I would not mind.
Go ahead, thank Representative. You.
Mr. Chair, Mike Schaffler, State Representative, District 48, Happy Valley County. And I'm generally just a passive, quiet observer of this process, so I'm kind of nervous. Be easy on me.
We're not written. You don't have to take a
okay, House Bill
swear 20, on the Bible.
House Bill 2463 would exempt unemployment insurance benefits from state taxation. We talked a lot about eliminating tax breaks here in the state of Oregon. This would add one to it. But it's going to, it, depending on how it comes out, it would definitely help some of the poorest workers here in the state of Oregon add to their purchasing power, which would be a direct infusion of money into our economy that needs all the help it can get. Let me see. There's been a lot of discussion over the last election cycle and the last years about cutting taxes for the rich and companies that collect taxes and don't send it back to us. I just think this would be a great message to regular working folks out there that we do care about them, that we do care about their families and their ability to pay their bills and have just a relatively decent life. I did pass out, stapled to the copy of the bill, a chart that shows a breakdown of $10,000 increments. And there will be a revenue impact on this. And as it said, it will be referred to ways and, revenue. But even if we did cut it off at one of the lower levels, like I did some math, if it was just $30,000 or less, that would reach, that's 87,807 tax returns of families and workers out there that could really use this money. I mean, at these numbers, 2005, 2006, that's only a $15 million hit to our revenue sources. And as we found out Friday, we got more money coming in than we anticipated, so a lot more people are working. So really, I think I can confidently say that that number will actually be less if we cut it off there, and it just goes up even greater as you go up. Personally, I would eventually phase out the whole thing, get rid of taxing unemployment benefits completely here in the state. Why should somebody who had to go and file for unemployment get stuck with a bill once they get back on their feet? It just doesn't really personally make a lot of sense to me. Let me see what else here. I understand that California and Alabama already do this, and Wisconsin has a threshold of $12,000 or less. But I, once again, I just want to say this makes perfectly good sense. This is good policy for the state of Oregon. This is going to help working families and the people that need it the most. And in this, in this climate, I just can't believe folks wouldn't, in general, be supportive of something like this. And it would help our economy immediately. So that's pretty much it for me this morning. I'd be happy to try and answer any relevant questions the best of my ability.
Thank you, Representative. Do you know what the federal poverty level is? What dollar figure is it?
I think it's $18,000. I think.
It's very depends on family size.
The and I think I heard on the news this morning too, or yesterday, that the latest unemployment percentage for the state was going to be out today. I don't know, maybe the employment people can have that.
That I heard that too. You know, and what's really strange is this has been a great source of revenue, oddly enough, during recession and. Why we're taxing the people that need the money the most during the worst times is just simply beyond me. I mean, that's not a good, sound place to get revenue for the state of Oregon. We're putting a hardship on people that need the money the most in the worst of times. It just, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Thank you, Representative. Bob, you'd like to go ahead, please?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2463. This has been an issue that I've thought about for a long time, and I don't know why I didn't put the bill in an earlier session, but it came home in the last 2 years, since the last session, due to the recession, certainly in my industry and in construction, where I've witnessed so many of my affiliates lose homes, cars. They've been devastated. As the legislature last session extended benefits, I've seen people exhaust their unemployment. And then at the end of the day, you get to pay a tax, and you don't have any money. And it's just unfair. And I've looked and watched, and I asked Representative Schaffler to put the bill in for us this session because I wanted to get it, the issue. First of all, I'm not sure everybody in this building even knows that we tax unemployment benefits. If you ask any average person in the street who hasn't ever been on unemployment, they probably wouldn't believe you if you told them, yeah, you get taxed on your unemployment benefits. So I wanted that issue debated in the legislature. It has been a long recession. The other thing that's strange, I guess, when you look at public policy that the representative touched on, this is a tax upon a tax that I believe the employers already paid taxes on as well. I can't find a similar situation in government or insurance, at least, where an individual is taxed on an insurance that they receive. Clearly, this money, if one subscribes to the proposition that tax cuts should go into the economy to stimulate the economy and get more people to work, clearly these people aren't putting it in the bank. It goes immediately into the economy to pay bills, buy goods and services. One of the things that a lot of folks don't realize, and you'll hear more about it in this committee, is that the whole purpose of unemployment insurance is to not only try and stabilize a family, but it was designed originally back in the 30s to stabilize communities so that commerce could continue in the communities, so people could pay their bills, they wouldn't have their houses foreclosed and things like that. So this is a bill that would help particularly in the rural parts of the state, and I know the legislature is always looking at, and I certainly support doing what I can to try and help rural communities and their economies. But when you look at the unemployment rates in areas of the state, clearly this money would go directly into those communities and perhaps make a difference, I think so. A couple last things. The only other two things I want to add is I think that clearly there has been a lot of discussion and debate in the last few years about tax cuts. But I think the representative is correct. When have people on unemployment or threatened with unemployment actually heard about something that might benefit them? And this bill would do that. So I'd like to get the bill just put in the mix down in Revenue Committee. I saw last week that the House Revenue Committee is now beginning to do what's known as the federal reconnect to try and see where the state is going to connect with the federal tax system. So I'd like to have that in the mix down there so that the Revenue Committee can make some policy decisions as to what the legislature feels is the proper taxes that this state should levy. I also, in closing, also want to tell you that I spoke to both Senator Gordon Smith and Senator Ron Wyden, both who are on the Senate Finance Committee, and they're both quite intrigued with this as well. And so I'm going to send them a copy of the bill, and maybe we'll get a debate at the federal level as well as to whether or not this is a proper thing to do. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
Mike Schaffler, just to add one more thing. I understand there's certain quarters that are folks that are afraid of or have concerns about the relating clause, and I share their anxiety. It does relate to exemption from
representative
state.
Not concerned on this end of the building,
yeah,
but on the other end,
right.
Other people might believe.
And I can appreciate that. Just for the record, that was definitely not this representative's intention. My intention here is just to help working folks, and I would hope that's what the way this bill and its relating clause would be used.
Representative, if you had to pick a level, if to cut this off at, where would your suggestion be?
Oh boy, I don't know. That's a tough one. I would want to reach as many people as we could, and as I said, I mean, I said at 30,000, but if you just jump up to 35,000, that's another 11,640 tax returns, and not that much more money, and it just keeps going up like that until about 50,000-60,000, then it starts decreasing. So I just as many people as we can reach, that's what I would do, and that doesn't help you much, but I just threw that number out there to show you the impact that this is. I mean, $30,000 is not very much money, especially if you have a child and rent and all the other bills that normal people do. It's not very much money, so I think you could justify taking it up, especially in joint returns, up to $45,000-$50,000, because if you're married and have children, that's really not that much. That goes really fast, too. So I guess I'm not being of much help to you, Mr. Chair, but if I have to decide, I'll make that decision when the time comes. But
okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He touched on the question I had you've got some information on the thresholds. Are you going to leave it up to revenue to come up with a threshold, or are you just going to leave thresholds out of this discussion completely and just make it across the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, right now we're just leaving it wide open. I personally would eventually phase it out completely. 2 years ago, in this very same committee, we had people that were laid off from Intel that were making six figures and more that came in and were begging us to extend their unemployment insurance benefits. These folks have locked mortgages, car payments, kids have got to go to college, and they're at all levels of the income spectrum. So I think eventually
as Mr. Shipwreck said, I would just get rid of all of it. It's taxed on a tax, on tax dollars. It just doesn't make any sense, especially when you finally do get on your feet, you get another bill. It just doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think the average Oregonian would agree. I'm just speculating on that, but eventually I'd phase it out for everybody. But if you know, hopefully we can reach at least a, you know, I think we could easily reach 100,000 returns, which include not just individuals but people with families and mortgages and all that good stuff, college payments. You want to add anything on that?
The only thing I'd add, Mr. Chair, is and Representative Holby, there are some folks from the Employment Department. The numbers, as I understand, that Representative Schaffler had were from tax year 2003, I believe, which I was told was the highest year of unemployment payments in the history of the state. So the number that we're looking at is the highest number that you're going to have, and I think, and they'll explain that. But so that's the worst case scenario that we're looking at. Hopefully.
Representative Kitts.
Representative Schaffler and Bob, I support the bill, and I support the concept of the bill, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. And I think you have very, very beyond adequately articulated what happens when people are taxed. And I think that the same articulation of your argument for people on unemployment benefits applies to those that are actually working as well and making $50,000 a year, that have those same trials and tribulations as related to higher tax rates, not no tax rates. So thank you for bringing the bill forward, and thank you for realizing that lower taxes do stimulate the economy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, on April 14th, I'll gladly bring my wife in to testify to that.
I too support the bill, and I commend you for bringing this forward. In my earlier work career, many years ago, I seemed like every winter I got the opportunity to draw my unemployment insurance, and I didn't remember that it was taxed. Maybe it wasn't at that time, but I knew I needed every penny I got at that time to feed four kids.
I think, Mr. Chair, the Employment Department can answer that, but I believe this was the early 80s was when Congress began taxing unemployment insurance, and Oregon adopted that. We're asking that Oregon disconnect now from that.
Okay. Is there any other states that have an income tax that don't tax unemployment?
Mr. Chair, I understand California and Alabama, I understand, are exempt, and Wisconsin has a threshold of $12,000 or less. I'm not sure if that's for individual or joint. And there may be more. I'm not sure. The nice people at the Employment Department are continuing to do diligent research on that.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Testifying. Is anyone from the agency want to? Any comments? Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2463. And committee, I'm going to have a conversation with the revenue chair, and then we'll move it try to by Friday to see what they expect. Okay. And is there anything else, Janet?
We have
okay. Which one is that? We'll open our work session to introduce LC 2404 as a House, or as a committee bill. House bill. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move we introduce LC 2404 as a committee bill, business and labor.
Representative Kitts moves we introduce LC 2404 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, it is adopted as a committee bill. And anything else, Janet?
Mr. Chair, has anyone got any discussion about the, it'll be a week from Friday, the meeting in Portland? If there's any questions at this time or special things you would like to do up there?
Representative Gibbs.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, as I indicated to you prior, my committee that I chair, the Rules and Elections Committee, will be having a committee meeting also on that day, so I will not be able to attend. Representative Holby, as my vice chair, has the discretion to attend either committee. He'll have an excused absence from my committee if he needs to go to the Business and Labor Committee.
Janet?
Mr. Chair, we're scheduled to be through by noon or so, and your meeting is in the afternoon in McMinnville, is my understanding.
It's a work in progress.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It may have changed.
Okay.
It may be in Eugene that day.
Oh,
Mr. Chair, I will not. I will be coming to the committee meeting,
okay,
but I'll be driving here right after we're done.
Okay.
You'll do it.
So I won't be doing. Well, I always do sufficient day one.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I was hoping to make it to both committees, so hopefully we work that out. But
that's
we'll
litigation.
See.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Not. We are adjourned.
Thank you, Janet. That's much.